Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast for teachers of physics, made by physics teachers. It's exactly what it says on the tin. Hello, Robin. Welcome to Episode 7. Extraordinary. Episode 7. We're still going.
We're still going. We haven't been taken off air. That's only because nobody's found us yet. I think they're out looking. I'm sure I saw people out earlier on looking angry with a pitchfork and some torches. But we're doing quite well. It's 7 is great. And we have more listeners than we have episodes, which I think was always an ambition.
That's one of the many ambitions we have. One day I think I'll blog about what we decided success was.
Yes.
In our limited way. When we get closer. We're doing okay, though. Now, one of the consistent themes in the podcast is us forgetting to introduce ourselves. So I'm going to do this properly today. Hello, my name is Thomas WP. Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast. I'm a part-time A-level only physics teacher.
And hello, I'm Robin Griffiths. I used to teach physics. I taught physics in state comprehensive schools for 9 years. But more recently, I've been working for the Institute of Physics, leading their program of teacher support, which is a privilege, as I always say. It really is. It's a privilege to work with great teachers of physics all throughout the UK. I do have to stress, however, that views expressed on this podcast are my own and do not belong to the Institute. When I skulk in the morning after the podcast is released, people look at me in tuft and shake their heads, and rightly so.
And I also thought it would be worth talking about why we're doing this. We only covered that in the first episode, and now we have more than my mum listening. It'll be worth mentioning that. I'm a part-time physics teacher, as I said, and I'm the only physics teacher in my school. My lovely colleague is on maternity leave this year. I miss talking to physics teachers. I feel I can talk to them in a different way than I can to other science teachers and certainly other teachers in the school. I'd started this with you, Robin, partly because I was lonely and partly because talking to you and what you're finding out, you'd said to me something like 50% of schools have one physics teacher.
Or zero or one. Yeah, it's over 50% have zero or one physics teachers.
And our challenge is to reach out and give those solo teachers an opportunity to network in this limited way through the podcast. That was my ambition, is try and reach those people. I think that's our greatest challenge, really, is those poor souls who might want to talk about the jelly chair or the difference between mass and weight and how to teach it. How do we reach them?
Well, this is it. So I'd echo that. I mean, and people who teach physics, I think, are the most wonderful enabling heroes in the world. They open up a vista of opportunity to kids in a fascinating subject for kids. And many of them are not people who would identify themselves as physics teachers. And it's just, I spent a lot of my career wasting time on bad professional development. And that was just, I guess, a function of the fact that people didn't really know what good professional development was at the time. And that's getting a more sophisticated field at the moment. People kind of know what good professional development looks like now, and that's good. And people have kind of arrived at the idea that the best way to develop yourself professionally as a teacher is to communicate with other teachers. And this is just a way of communicating with other teachers, particularly when you don't have that fellow physics teacher to bounce ideas off, which is so important.
Yes, I agree. And that's the other person I wanted to reach with this. I spend some of my time supporting colleagues teaching physics, and I felt if we could maybe explain the ways to teach some of the physics that non-specialists could benefit from, that might be some good we could do as well. And that's why I've been quite precious and singularly failed at this, but quite precious about saying teachers of physics, because I feel that's people who are teaching physics who aren't specialists versus physics teachers.
Yeah, and I think it's a bit of a spectrum as well. It's tied up with confidence, it's tied up with experience, it's tied up with all sorts of things. There are people out there who would identify as physics teachers, but they have less experience teaching physics than someone who's a biology teacher who's been teaching for 20 years, for example. And so everybody can learn from everybody else. There's something that they can pick up. That biology teacher could pick up some content knowledge that's specific to physics from the new physics teacher. The new physics teacher could pick up some of the experience that biology teacher has gained over 20 years of going through the same physics practicals and tweaking them and improving them every year. So it's not quite as easy as saying specialist, non-specialist. There are teachers of physics. They're all heroes. And we would like to recognize you professionally and give you somewhere where you can say hi to each other.
So we're trying to reach people who are physics teachers or teachers of physics or people who will find this podcast useful. And to do that, we've started a competition. We have some lovely t-shirts. You can see them on Twitter or Facebook.
Beautiful.
Or our new Instagram account. To celebrate the new Instagram account, we're having a competition to win a t-shirt with our wonderful logo, I'm at the bottom of an exponential, in the colour and size of your choice.
Yeah, we've already had to copyright it in case the fashion houses of Paris try to get in muscle in on our acts, but no, they won't get a look in with this. It's only for one lucky listener of the podcast.
I was rather shooting from the hip at the last podcast when I introduced the competition, and I caught you on the hoof, but it's developed slightly. It was tweet us, just tweet to us, but now it's interact with us in any way. If you follow us on Instagram, if you comment on the Facebook page, if you tweet us, if you retweet us, we'll find all those people, we'll put it in a big machine, we'll turn the handle and see what pops out.
Yeah, and we've decided that an all-expenses-paid trip for both of us to head to wherever you are to present the T-shirt to you with the associated photo opportunity would be good. So please, any teachers in the West Indies, please feel very free to enter that competition, and it won't be rigged in any way, shape or form at all, I promise, honest.
Another way to interact with us would be send us an email, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com. Now, I think we've blathered on long enough, Robin. Let's get into the meat of the episode. We trailed this last week. So in episode 3, we had a lovely chat with Lauren, or I had a lovely chat with Lauren about what she was doing up in Blackpool, and she mentioned a book by Ben Rogers. And I, through the wonders of modern media, just tweeted Ben Rogers and said, hey, we should have a chat about this. And it happened. And I had a delightful chat with him the other day. So I'm going to play it to you now.
I'm Ben Rogers. I've been teaching 20-odd years. I was 18 years as a secondary high school teacher, then did 4 years in a primary school, and now I'm working across both. I wrote a book last year, came out in April this year, called The Big Ideas in Physics and How to Teach Them.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Ben. I'm really pleased to meet you virtually. My first question is, can you tell me how you got into cognitive science, because I obviously had never heard of it when I talked to Lauren. Now I've read your book, I find it fascinating, and it has impacted my practice.
I think I would. Who would I hold accountable? Hattie got me started. I got the visible learning and got into his evidence based approach, and then it was Twitter that led me from there to Daniel Willingham. Dylan William, lots of blogs that I follow. There's a lot of cognitive science blogs, which are amazing and brilliant. Dylan William, I think, does an amazing job at tweeting and promoting other people. So following him, just following his links, has taken me all over the place. So it's been a real gradual accumulation. But actually, we've got I live in Norwich. We've got Nikki Kay, who's a brilliant science teacher and advocate of cognitive science, and she's led a big movement called CogSciSci, which is cognitive science in science, and it's just ballooning. It's really exciting.
So you didn't meet it on your PGCE, what did you say, 20 years ago? It's something you've entirely come across as you've developed as a teacher.
100%. Interestingly, it did exist then. A lot of the research we're reading, John Sweller's work was published in the 80s, and I did my PGCE in 94, 95. So it was there. A lot of this stuff's been floating around for quite a long time, but it seems to have its moment. And I think social media, Twitter in particular, has been excellent at bringing that forward. And it may well be an echo chamber where I follow the people who like this sort of stuff, but everyone seems to be talking about it. It's been a very rewarding and fruitful area of interest. The other people that I would recommend you follow is Learning Scientists, because they've got a very good summary and posters and podcasts. It's excellent.
My understanding of cognitive science, having read your book, is it's basically making it easier for students so that there's a lower bar to learning what they're learning, and then you build on that first step until you get to the end product, which is the exam. Does that make sense? It's reducing the demand on them to make it easier to access the content.
I think you've got to be a bit careful with saying it makes it easier, because learning is hard work. I think more important is the idea that you're taking away the distractions and you're focusing on the one thing you want them to learn. So if you're doing a practical, or if you're doing a demonstration, or if you're doing group work, you absolutely take away all of the, they may be important things, but it's not the thing you're focusing on. So if you're, all of the social skills, all of the arranging on the page, all of that sort of stuff, if that's not what you wanted them to learn, then do that bit for them, or make it easier for them so they can really focus their attention on the difficult, challenging bit that you really want them to learn.
And this leads us quite nicely into practicals. When I told someone I was going to interview, they said, "Oh, Ben Rogers, he doesn't like practical work, does he?" So having read the book, I'm not sure that's your view, but I thought I'd give you a chance to defend yourself.
I'm very ambivalent about practical work. I see it as totally integral to learning physics and learning science. And without it, without practical work, I think you're not doing the children a service. But at the same time, if you see, I'm guilty of this, all of the long drawn out practicals where there's 100 things going on, you're asking your pupils to do things that they're really on the edge of their ability at the same time as working socially, all the distractions going on, measuring. And you ask them the next day, "Oh, do you remember doing that experiment?" They remember. They remember who they sat with. They remember the funny thing that happened when so-and-so bag fell on the floor or whatever it is. And you say, "Yeah, okay, so but what were they learning? What were you learning?" And they just stare at you. So I think practical work is tremendously important, but I think it can be an absolute waste of time if you're not very careful and do it very mindfully and intentionally.
Yes, giving them clear instructions about what they're doing and setting it up for them if setting up the practical is not what the aim is. That's something I've learned relatively late in my career, is that it takes so much to get some practicals running. Like I teach AQA, we have a required practical, which is dropping a ball bearing through two light gates.
Yeah.
And I realized that they take ages getting the light gate set up, and it's pointless, completely useless. That's
yes.
not what we're looking at. We're looking at the, can they record the right data? Can they adjust the gap between the light gates? So I've taken that out of the game now. I get my technician and we set it all out before them.
I mean, I know it's a shame that all of these things are important, but the most precious resource that teachers have is time, isn't it? And to lose a bit of time, quite a lot of time setting up a practical, and then sort of rushing through at the end and not having the chance to review and really think about what is that showing us. If you're not doing that, they'll remember the bits that they either enjoyed or they spent most of their mental energy on, which is, you know, making sure that things lined up and dropping the marble through it, which is play. And you know, it's not progressing them as scientists.
I like that idea that you have. You want their mental energy to be directed at learning the physics, not at play. That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, and you know, all that play is important. But you know, we've all done it as physicists. I think do we talk about play quite a lot? I'm playing with this oscilloscope or so on. It is important, but we just don't have the time for it. So you know, it's a trade off, isn't it?
Yeah, and I do think you can train up the kids so some things become automatic. And I hope at the end of 2 years that my A level students, I can give them a very open practical. I want you to tell me if there's an inverse square law for this light bulb, that they can then assemble it, because they have learned all those skills because I've done it in small steps. So then their mental energy in the last few weeks of the course is, what's the best way to go about this in the limited time that I have? Does that seem fair?
I think so. I like I say, I think it would be a shame not to be able to do all that stuff. But I think you need to do it with, it needs to be planned. And it might be 10 minutes at the end saying, right, okay, now I want you to set it up with the bulb, or now I want you to have a go at setting up the light bulbs yourself, or whatever it is. But it probably isn't the main learning point of the lesson.
I think what you say makes a lot of sense. Cut out the fluff. Concentrate the mental energy on the learning. Makes a lot of sense.
Even if there are two real important learning points, do them separately. Don't. If you try and do them simultaneously, you won't be able to do either well, or the learners won't be able to learn either particularly well.
Another thing I enjoyed in your book is refutation texts, Would you like to talk about those for a little bit?
Well, refutation texts, and I can't remember. I was Googling. I suspect it was early one morning. I was Googling how to deal with misconceptions, and it came up. The idea is that we don't ever overwrite misconceptions and get rid of them. They're always there lurking deep down and will come up in stressful situations like exams or when you're giving a presentation or when you're doing a podcast. They'll always come to the surface then. So the idea is that you layer on top of the misconception an additional piece of knowledge, which is, but that's wrong. And the right version is this. So one of the examples I've got is many people think that positive charge moves in a metal, but ... And then as a teacher, you'd have a number of solutions ready in your pocket, like, but it's electrons that move, or but it's negative charges that move, or but it's electrons that move which have negative charge, something like that. So you get the children developing. They're writing out themselves. They're having to think about the misconception. They're having to learn the cap on top of their misconception is, but that's wrong, and this is the right version.
Yes, it's another example of how doing the podcast has changed my practice, because I'm actually working on one of those for the jelly chair for when I teach it next week. If you're an avid listener, Ben, you'll know all about the jelly chair.
I do know about the jelly chair.
When I get the perfect question, I'll put it on the blog and I'll try and mention it in the next podcast. And that refutation text that you talk about reminds me of something that I loved in your book and had to do straight away, and I will put a photo on the website, is the Vasorium needle, which I had not heard of, and it's just the easiest thing to do and so impressive. I love that.
It feels like magic, doesn't it? And I didn't know it before I was doing the research for the book either. So it's basically an electroscope. It detects charge, and it's the way that I make it with students is you make an elongated diamond shape out of tin foil, and you fold it in half, so you've got a needle that will balance. If you put a blob of blue tack and a cocktail stick, you can balance it on there, so it's free turning like a compass needle, except that it's not magnetized in any way. If you bring a positive charged object to it, the negative from the other end will come up to the end, so it will attract. If you bring a negative one to it, the negative will go to the other end, so you've got a positive and negative. It will always attract. And it was Gilbert of Colchester who invented this, and he was a fascinating character, 1600, who invented this thing. And it feels like magic when you do it with the kids. Really impressive.
It is beautiful and moves very violently, I found, when I made it. The other thing in your book that I haven't got around to making but I want to make is the little mini Leyden jar which you cover in health warnings. Do I need to be scared?
Don't put it near a Van de Graaff. Really don't. It does have a significant capacitance if you had a decent voltage on it. I use it for demonstration purposes. The literature's hilarious about one of the guys who was experimenting on it. He was too scared, but his wife did it and she passed out, and then she had another go. It was amazing.
Which brings me on to the stories. I mean, a great part of your book is the wonderful stories, the back stories. Now, I use stories where I can, but you've given me lots more ammunition. Did you know all those, or was that hours of grinding research?
It was lots of train journeys. A lot of this original stuff is on the archives on the internet, and you can download it and read it through. And it's all got the F's and the S's, all, you know, it's the proper old stuff, but it's remarkably readable and full of anecdote and character. I enjoyed it. I didn't know it all. One thing led to another and led to another. But I would say sort of 70-80% of the time I spent on the book was researching and writing those. But you see, I think it's important that you've got these backstories. Stories go in so much better than other forms of knowledge. And if you've got a story that can make sense of where this idea came from, I think it's very powerful. And the book was really originally conceived as a shortcut for new teachers and especially the huge number of teachers teaching physics who aren't specialists. So you wouldn't have all this stuff to mind anyway, and it takes years to build up these backstories. So it was intended as a shortcut.
I found it refreshing reading a book written for physics teachers. I've been teaching since, I would say, 1850 to the kids, but I've been teaching since the early 90s, and it was really refreshing to have a book that I felt was written for me. And I've been teaching a long time, and I learned tons from it, and I was very grateful for it, Ben. So, Ben Rogers, author of The Big Ideas in Physics and How to Teach Them, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was really, really fascinating. It's really interesting. I've got so many thoughts about not only what Ben was talking about, but ideas he's thrown up about, you know, how teachers teach and how they improve their teaching and, you know, ways they pitch their teaching theory, their pedagogy, I guess. It's really, really interesting. What did you think?
Well, it's already changed my practice. I actually blogged about this on our website, thephysicsteachingpodcast.com, this week. And something I normally would have done, I thought, ooh, that's play. That's not helpful. That's play. So instead of letting them have 15 minutes downtime making little rockets to put on my pressure rocket launcher, I made them myself. And it was better. It was definitely better. So thanks, Ben. Reading the book has really made me think about my practice, even after all these many thousands of years I've been teaching.
But I think it's really indicative to me of how these things work. Now, Ben's book is great, and it talks about this idea of, you know, if you look at it from the point of view of cognitive science, it can really help you in just zeroing in on the most important learning moments in your practical. And who would argue with that? It's absolutely the right thing to do. But you could also see how if people took it to extremes, it might start to edge out other areas of practice that are good for you. And this is it. So Ben's take on it is really healthy. It's really good. His book is really, really informative, and it's a great perspective. But it is only one weapon in a teacher's arsenal, and it is worth thinking about everything that you do and things that you do. And avoid this idea that there is one answer to anything. It's not just one. There's no such thing as a panacea. That's what 9 years in teaching taught me. There's no such thing as a one size fits all. There's lots of good ways to think about things, but it doesn't negate all the other points of view that you've thought from as well. And finding your own accommodation between all those different points of view is basically your teaching style, and that's going to be individual to you.
That's very true. And I think for me, it's changed my whole career.
You're trying these new ideas, and they're making a difference in your teaching. But what you're not doing, which is really good, is binning everything that you've got. This is the only way to do things from now on. And I'm not saying that Ben's arguing for that. He's absolutely not. But the trouble is that some people latch onto these ideas, and they are so good and so enlightening that they suddenly think that that's the only idea that's worth propagating, and the only idea that's worth promoting. And that's a dangerous thing for me. I've seen that happen in too many things in sort of initiatives gone by. So do make sure, you know, read Ben's book. There's lots of good stuff in there. It will help your practice, but don't just throw everything out and start again. There's no need for a radical solution. The experience you've built up is good. You can hone it. You can mold it. And this is what Ben's arguing for, I think. You know, you can make your practice better, but you don't have to dig it up by the roots and start again.
One of the examples of that is models. You've mentioned that before, the rote model being the one and only model. But no, it's its own model with its own flaws, and it's just another tool in the toolbox for the teachers.
When you're an experienced teacher like you, what you do is you'll try this, and then you evaluate it in your head afterwards, because that's natural to you now, and you don't even think about it twice, probably. But you think about what the kids learned, you think about what the kids have done, you think about what they've achieved in the lesson, and in your mental balance sheet, it comes out with a plus, and you think, yes, that's a good thing to do. And it is that process of professional reflection that's so important to every teacher that you to go through, to think about what you're applying and think about how it's gone across, and to think about whether the kids' learning has been better as a result. And then you absorb that into your toolkit of techniques, and you build your practice as you go on, but you don't keep demolishing it and rebuilding it as something else.
It has made me reflect the book. I had two students back for a little bit of help. They had some misconceptions I wanted to address. And I asked them whilst I was talking to them about what they remembered of different practicals. Now, I just talked to Ben, and it was a bit humbling how little they remembered of the practicals. It was almost exactly how we described it. That has given me huge pause for thought, because, you know, I love a practical. I love a practical. My whole practice is around practicals. And I feel my faith in them has been shaken somewhat. But I think it's because I'm giving them too much to do. And as I said in the interview, I have been realizing over the years that you've got to make it easier and easier and easier and concentrate on the learning. So I think I'm on the right path. But I think one thing, even if you didn't agree with cognitive science, what's brilliant in that book is the history. I love the history. I love, particularly love the Verisorium needle. I'm very keen, and I'm assembling the components to make the Leyden jar. But the Verisorium needle is so easy to make. I made it in 10 seconds, literally, and showed it to the Kisei, head of Kisei's 3 in my school. She was delighted. It's brilliant.
It is a great book, to be honest, and well worth reading for all those reasons. And cognitive science, I have to say, I think there's a great deal of mileage in it. And you mentioned Willingham there, Daniel Willingham, who if you read some of his stuff, it just strips the whole idea of learning back to the very basics. And he defines learning as converting short-term memory into long-term memory. And that's pretty much, he says, you know, you learn something if something goes from the short-term memory into the long-term memory. And that should be the aim when you are teaching. And at some level, you know, you can't really argue with that. And it's a beautifully simple thing to think about. And then you can build from there and work it through. So cognitive science is a really interesting tool in any teacher's toolkit. And I would encourage all teachers to have a look at it and see how they can best fit it into their practice.
Let's call it a day there, Robin. It's been a delight as ever.
It's been fabulous. Thank you so much. Yes, thank you for episode 7. We'll be back in episode 8 and talking to Carol Kenrick, who is a fabulous teacher of physics and of science generally. She used to be a secondary physics teacher and is now teaching at primary level, amongst other things. And we'll hear all about her many Venn diagram hats, and also we'll hear from her cat, Dr. Benji, who made a guest appearance.
Outstanding. Thank you very much, Robin, and I'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. It's not too late to enter the competition. Just interact with us somehow in the next couple of days, and we'll announce the winners in episode 8. You can email us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com, tweet us @PhysicsTP, or maybe follow us on Instagram, Physics Teaching Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.